nice network you've got there to be ashamed if something were to happen to it.
You know, that's the phrase that we used to use to kind of be emblematic or to characterize how these government officials were acting. They didn't actually use those words. That would be too absurd. But in this case, Brendan Carr literally said, we can do this the easy way or the hard way.
Yeah, there you go.
It was unbelievable. Talk about saying the quiet part out loud.
It's not boss talk. It's just amazing. Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join us today. I am delighted to welcome Nico Perino of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Nico, thank you so much for joining me. I know I dragged you away from book writing, and I know what that feels like, especially when there's a deadline looming. So especially thankful that you were willing to come and join me today.
Well, it is the end of the day. And at the end of the day, 6 hours into writing, I think I'm ready to do something different. So happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. There are diminishing returns.
Sure are.
The reason I wanted to speak with you today is because I think we're facing a kind of unprecedented assault on the First Amendment. You're an expert on this topic, and so I would welcome your insights. But before we do that, I'd just like to get to know you a little bit. What made you, what's your background, your parents, where'd you grow up, and what made you passionate about free expression?
I grew up outside Chicago in a suburb called Elmhurst, mm-hmm. and it was actually there that some of the early seeds of my interest in free speech and the First Amendment were sown. In my fifth grade class, Mr. Shields' class, we put on the play about the trial of John Peter Zenger. Now, for your listeners who are historians of American colonial history, they might recognize that name. John Peter Zenger, I believe in the 1740s, was tried for seditious libel in the then colony of New York because of criticisms that he published in his newspaper of the then colonial governor, William Crosby. Now, when you think of the word libel today, you think of something that's defamatory, something mm-hmm. that's false that's said about someone. But in those days, they had this concept of seditious libel, which meant if you said something that was merely just critical of someone in power, you could go to jail for that. Mm-hmm. And so John Peter Zenger was tried. He was brought before a jury of his peers, and he was acquitted despite being obviously guilty of seditious libel. And this was one of the early moments in American history where we started to reject this old conception of free speech. It's one of the early instances of jury nullification and one of the early instances where America started, even before it became America, to sow the seeds of the First Amendment, just as in my putting on that play sowed the seeds of my interest in the First Amendment. But as I went on in my into my middle school and high school careers, I had an interest in sports. I had an interest in music. I was actually in a death metal band, believe it or not. Used to have longer hair, wore black t-shirts, had a chain on my pants. But I had a teacher my junior year in high school.
By the way, you've just improved my standing with the audience immeasurably.
I was much cooler in those days. Lot less cool now. But my junior year of high school, I had a teacher, Michael Torney, who was one of those sort of inspiring teachers that you hope to get as you're going through your education, who really opened my eyes into the world of politics and philosophy. And I started to get an interest in free speech issues, constitutional issues, civil liberties issues. This was the era of the Patriot Act, for example. So we were having mm-hmm. a lot of national discussions about issues of free speech and privacy and due process, for example. And so when I got to college, I started joining student groups, started engaging in debates and discussions, and started to try and reform my college, Indiana University's speech codes, after I became an intern at FIRE, spending my sophomore year in Philadelphia working on these issues. So that's the short history, so to speak. Now I've been at FIRE for 13 years. I planned originally to maybe be here for two.
Wow.
Here I am, and I'm not planning on leaving anytime soon.
No, I would hope not. What's your book about?
I'm writing a book that's tentatively titled The Civil Libertarians, How a Generation of Lawyers, Writers, and Activists Created the Free Speech Century. Most Americans don't realize that for the first 140 or so years of American history, the First Amendment's protections of free speech meant more or less nothing. Prior to 1931, the Supreme Court had never struck down a speech restriction on First Amendment grounds, not once. Mm-hmm. That year, mm-hmm. it did it twice. And so what happened that prior to 1931, you could be put in jail, as Margaret Sanger was, for distributing birth control literature, or as one New York politician did for distributing socialist literature? That would be unthinkable today.
Wasn't Eugene V. Debs sent to prison for circulating literature opposing the First World War?
Yes, a lot of people were. So in that mm-hmm. era, something like 2,500 people were prosecuted under what was then the Espionage and Sedition Act mm-hmm. for their criticisms of the United States government during World War I. And Eugene Debs was sent to jail for saying that draftees were worth something more than cannon fodder. Mm-hmm. He was later mm-hmm. pardoned, I believe, but he and many others were thrown in jail. In some cases, they were thrown in jail for just talking about America's fighting the war during the Revolution against the British, because during World War I, we were allies of the British, and it was seen to be illegal to say anything critical of them during that time. But
that's really amazing. Yeah,
this would have been unthinkable, you know, in the 2000s. Right. So how do you go from that world to this mm-hmm. world? And so mm-hmm. my book is the story of that evolution. And it's not a legal history, although there's some of that. It's not a philosophical history, although there's some of that. It's a generational biography of the lawyers, writers, and activists who made the so-called free speech century possible, told from their perspective. And the inspiration for that came from my attending the funeral of the late writer Nat Hentoff. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with him.
Oh, yes.
A great
Nat Hentoff, yes.
Yeah, the sort of guy who would put his skunk suit on and walk into the garden party and just blow up anyone's sort of orthodoxies or shibboleths.
Well, it's true. He really, he was truly an independent spirit, and I would recommend that anybody who's not familiar with his writing might want to give him a look, because it's very rare to find someone who's so principled. You know, he was a civil libertarian. He was more of a man of the left than the right, but he was pro-life because yes. those were his convictions. And so, you know, he wasn't going to be bullied into withdrawing an inch on any subject that he felt strongly about, right?
No, and he even endorsed Sarah Palin as John McCain's running mate in that 2008 election. I don't know if he had any role in that choice, but yeah, he kind of defined description. And in his obituary that was put out by the Associated Press when he passed in January of 2017, the first line from the Associated Press was that something to the effect of free-thinking writer and author Nat Hentoff passed away. I believe he was mm-hmm. 93. Can you just mm-hmm. imagine that being the first line of your obituary, free-thinking author and writer? It's just amazing. But yeah. I attended his funeral, and there in the audience were all these civil libertarians I admired. But they had retired from the barricades. In the case of Nat Hentoff, they were passing away. And I wanted to be able to kind of capture their story. Why did they do what they did? Can the legacy that they're leaving behind endure? In 2017, when Nat Hentoff passed away, I thought there's very little that could be done to erode the advances of the First Amendment in those years. There were challenges to it, of course, stemming mainly from the political left. But today, when I'm talking to those civil libertarians and they're looking at the government and what it's doing in regards to censorship, they're having questions about whether that legacy can endure and whether that free speech century that they have identified can endure.
First of all, let me just say, I'm so thrilled that your fifth grade teacher assigned you that play, because the meaning of the John Peter Zenger story is, at least the way I was taught it and what I do think it represented, is that the convictions about liberty were in the public. They were deep in people's hearts, the sense that at the time they thought of their rights as Englishmen, but it would become very soon, in a few decades, their rights as Americans. And so even though it wasn't given as an option, you know, that they could say, well, this is an unjust prosecution, but they acquitted him in an act, as you say, of jury nullification, saying this is this person who's just speaking his mind, and that's a basic American freedom. And it was always taught to me as an inspiring story. And I hope, I mean, obviously your teacher carried on that tradition, but, you know, when I was growing up, It was simply axiomatic that the key liberty that we enjoy in this country is freedom of expression. You know, it was just part of the warp and woof of society. It was, you know, it's a free country. You know, I can, you know, everybody was quoting Voltaire. He probably didn't even say it, but you know, you know how you try to look up a quote and it's never what you
think. It was his biographer, Evelyn Beatrice Hall, who was summarizing his beliefs, but we'll give it to Voltaire.
We'll give it to him. Okay. Which is, I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. This was just, everybody agreed with this, and boy, it is just vertigo inducing how fast we have retreated from all of that. And as you say, there were a lot of assaults on free expression that arose from the left, the campus culture of cancellation, of shouting down speakers, declaring certain views. Now, it does get a little tricky because there are certain views that should be outside the Overton window, that should not be just treated with respect, in my opinion. You may disagree with that. I'd be interested if you do.
No, there are many views that I disagree with and that I would hold the speakers to account for. But
and I would criticize, for example, a university that issued an invitation, for example, to Nick Fuentes to speak. I would say, why are you, that's elevating him to a level of respect he doesn't deserve. Okay. Now, I wouldn't shout him down if he were invited. But anyway, I do think there are certain views that are so noxious that they shouldn't be respected. On the other hand, you've pointed out, and we're going to get to what the government is doing soon, but let's stick for now with the cancel culture and the universities. So first, do you agree with me that that would be that it would be a mistake to invite somebody like Nick Fuentes?
It depends what the class is on. So there are many classes that used to exist. They don't exist as much anymore, where the purpose of the class is to explore American extremism. You used to have these in high schools where they'd bring in members of the Black Panthers or members of the Ku Klux Klan. And the teacher said, we're bringing these people in so you can understand the radical left, the radical right, and interrogate them. And those classes are few and far between now. You used to see them in college as well. To bring Nick Fuentes into a college or university environment in a way that sort of endorses his views doesn't allow for an opportunity to interrogate those views, I think would probably be a mistake. I'll give you an example of something that once happened at Brown University's campus in 1966. George Lincoln Rockwell was invited to speak on that campus.
And he was invited. The head of the American Nazi Party.
The leader of the American Nazi Party. And he was invited by the students' main activities committee of the university. He was subsequently canceled. The president said this was a mistake. It showed a lack of good judgment on behalf of the committee. But then there was a student group that was formed called Open Mind. And Open Mind felt that this cancellation was also a mistake. They extended this invitation and they should have held to it so that there wasn't this atmosphere of political censorship or left-leaning neo-McCarthyism. They didn't agree with George Lincoln Rockwell, but they felt he should be able to speak if he was invited, and it was a bad precedent to send to revoke invitations in response to protests. At the time, there was a student. His name was Ken Miller. I believe he was a freshman in 1966, and he decided he was going to attend the event, and he always thought that fascism could never come to America. He thought our culture was too robust from it. He walks past Holocaust survivors who in 1966 are only in their 30s or 40s, who are showing him their tattoos and saying, how can we allow this person to speak on our campus? And then he sits down in the audience and he says later in a piece that he wrote that he found Rockwell charming, funny, and frankly disarming. He joked about how Rockwell himself was a Brown University graduate, and he joked about how he would come into campus, half drunk with a girl hanging from his arm, and he'd elicit a laugh from the audience. And Ken Miller said it was one of the most enlightening experiences he ever had at Brown University, because Rockwell brought to life with a sinister smile that day in Alumni Hall how a generation of Germans, Spaniards, and Italians could fall and be duped by Franco, Mussolini, and Hitler. And he learned in the most personal way possible that such demagoguery could come here to America. And he said he never would have appreciated that had he not had the personal experience of seeing a demagogue speak on his college campus. Now, you or someone might say, well, that just proves that we shouldn't allow these demagogues to speak, because not everyone's going to be Ken Miller. Not everyone's not going to fall for the deception. But I think there are certain lessons that can only be learned through experience, and that reading about the charm of Mussolini, for example, in a history book isn't going to put you on the defensive or on guard for the deception that they can provide. So I don't know how your listeners are going to come away from that story, but I was really taken with Ken Miller, who became a professor at Brown and wrote that op-ed that I'm citing after Ray Kelly, the police commissioner of New York City, longtime police commissioner of New York City, was shouted down in October of 2013. And he said that the students who shouted him down denied students then the right to have that personal experience that he had in 1966 when a Nazi was allowed to speak on campus.
So this is the fun part of doing a podcast with interesting people, because, you know, I thought the conversation was going to go in one direction and it's gone in a slightly different one that I wasn't thinking about, but I'm thinking about it now. And so here's the reality. I do think that the Overton window should be very broad, that only the most, you know, disgusting, reprehensible views should be non-platformed. Having said that, I don't know how I feel about that story. I worry that, you know, a university is by its very nature a place that confers respect when it invites someone. And so you can gain insight into how demagogues work without sitting in the room with them. I mean, you can watch, I watched the videos of Hugo Chavez doing his TV performances in Venezuela. He used to have a weekly TV show, and he was funny and entertaining and gripping, and he would sing.
Should those videos be allowed to be shown on campus?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one. Of course, that's about a foreign country, so it's very different. But I'm not 100% funny. I'm surprising myself. I'm not 100% sure that a university should invite, you know, people like that or Nick Fuentes. But I mean, they should certainly invite, you know, Charles Murray, who was another figure who was, you know, shouted down when he was at Middlebury College, and his views are, you know, considered offensive to many, but we're not talking about a person who's a Nazi. I mean, you know, and so I don't know. Okay.
Well, the challenge is, where do you draw the
line?
Where
do you draw the line?
And who draws the lines?
Right.
And at Brown University, that same university we were just talking about, there was a student petition to ban Guy Benson, a conservative commentator, from speaking on that campus because he was racist for supporting capitalism.
I know. And so that's the thing. If people are drawing lines in the wrong places, does that mean that no line drawing is ever correct? I'm not sure that one follows from the other. But let us turn from, because what we've been discussing up until now is private individuals being intolerant of other people's speech, and sometimes using informal ways to punish others for wrongthink, to use the Orwellian term. But we have moved in this country to a new place where it is the government that is the actor here, moving to quash free speech. And that is a category difference, right?
Yeah, it's a category difference. And it's something that FIRE wasn't really prepared to see with the advent of Trump 2.0, because we lived through Trump 1.0. And we haven't seen the same scope, scale, and severity with that previous administration that we're seeing now. So it's entirely different and has sort of taken us aback, to be frank.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of being taken aback, have you been as surprised as I have been by the degree to which leading institutions in American society have agreed to self-censor, have agreed to, make deals with the administration? You had, you had CBS settling a ridiculous lawsuit with Trump over the editing of a 60 Minutes interview. You've had, Meta settle their case with to give him several $1 million for the offense of having temporarily deplatformed him right after the January 6th thing. I mean, and certain law firms, Paul Weiss, have agreed to these draconian terms in the face of government pressure. Are you surprised that so many institutions have caved?
I wish I could say I was. I've been surprised in many different directions, and it probably depends on the institution you're talking about. But we're seeing something unprecedented right now. Now, these corporations that you're talking about, many of which are public companies that have shareholder interests that they need to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. In the case of some of these law firms, they have client interests that they need to keep in mind. If they fight the administration, will the administration come after their clients? Will they still be able to serve their clients in the same way if they're having to fire different lawyers because they no longer are getting the business that's necessary to support the institution that they've built? You should never have to worry about that sort of thing in the United States of America. We are not a banana republic where businesses only serve at the pleasure of the government.
Yep.
But nevertheless, that is the situation where we are in, where you have a general counsel or a senior partner at a law firm who's saying, if we don't make a deal with this administration, they're going to put pressure on us and our clients, and they're going to even lock us out of federal buildings. Query whether that includes federal courthouses, where if you're a lawyer, you need to have access.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
They're saying that no clients or no contractors who do business with the federal government can work with us as a law firm. I've never been put in that situation, so I don't know how I would respond. I'd like to think that I'd respond in the principled way, as many of the law firms that were targeted did, by taking their case to court and winning, as they should have, because it is such an obvious violation of the First Amendment. Just as it didn't implicate the First Amendment, and Trump had no leg to stand on when he sued Meta and Google for deplatforming him, I don't think he should have been deplatformed in the first place. I think it undermines a culture of free expression when you deplatform the president of the United States but allow the spokesperson for the Taliban to still have an account on your platform. Mm-hmm, it's frankly ridiculous.
Yes.
But at the same time, these are private platforms with their own First Amendment editorial rights to platform whatever speech they'd like. And as soon as Trump gets elected, they bend the knee and write a check to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars because they know that a retributive president is going to come after them if they don't. 60 Minutes did the same thing. I don't know whether I think 60 Minutes did the right thing or the wrong thing from a business perspective. They had the FCC investigating them. They had the president who was putting out truth posts every day saying they should lose their license, their broadcast licensees, their affiliate stations should lose their broadcast licensees. I don't know what it's like to be put in that situation. But at the same time, merely cutting up an interview with a presidential candidate to fit into a 13 to 20 minute news segment is something news outlets do every day when they're trying to cut down an hour long interview. And it shouldn't result in a threat to lose your license. And for 60 Minutes to cave and to put pressure on Bill Owens, the longtime executive producer there, to change its editorial standards and approach, because not doing so might mean that the FCC wouldn't approve a sale to Skydance Media from its parent company, Paramount, is ridiculous. None of that should happen in America. And behavior that gets rewarded gets repeated. And so exactly. Because these institutions are caving, other institutions are going to see that as well and think they need to cave too. And that's a problem. And finally, I'll just add, the one institution that has been standing up to the administration is Harvard University. And if you would have asked me if Harvard University would be the place, the institution with a backbone 2 years ago, I would have said, no chance in hell.
Yeah.
But they're still standing firm. There are reports that they're close to a deal with the administration, but I've been hearing those reports for months now. They've got a rock-solid First Amendment case as well. We'll see where it goes. It's before a district court judge right now.
These things are, in addition to being flagrant violations of the First Amendment, they're illegal in several other ways as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact is that the FCC is not allowed to pressure companies to comply with the administration's viewpoint on broadcast matters and to threaten their licenses or through the station's licenses. Networks don't have licenses, but to say that they're going to use the administration's authority to prevent a merger. I mean, that is the government would be behaving in an arbitrary or capricious manner, which is forbidden by the Administrative Procedure Act. There are other ways in which this is utterly illegal. There are contracts involved that, you know, they would be abrogating, for example, with Columbia University, where, you know, the administration can't just Welsh on a contract without consequences. They could have sued for breach of contract when they've agreed that, you know, Columbia will be doing X amount of research and will be receiving X amount of dollars from the federal government to do it. I mean, all of these things, just the thick membranes of laws, regulations, and rules that we all lived by and we thought were, if anything, a little bit too dense. Right. In this country have proved to be like spider webs. They're just dissolving in the onslaught that this administration is bringing forward. By the way, we should say we're recording the day after 2 days after the election. And there's reason to think that at the grassroots, in any case, the American people are pushing back on some of the things that the administration is doing. So that's a bit of a ray of hope. I mean, at least from my perspective. Let's take a moment and talk about our friends from GhostBed. As you know, we get opportunities to try different products here at the Bulwark. And I was willing to try a pillow from GhostBed, but maybe didn't expect too much. Mm-hmm. I was hoping it'd be a nice pillow. But when they said it keeps you cool, I thought, we'll see about that. And actually, I have to say, I don't know how they do it. I don't know what the materials are, but it does stay cool and feel cool against your body. And in fact, my husband loves it so much that he stole it. So the fact is that these pillows are designed, they have three different models. They're available in foam or hybrid, and they have two different firmnesses, medium or medium firm. And they have this patented cooling technology with breathable materials that remains cool all night. It actually does. They're also ergonomic, and they have a zoned support layer so they can relieve the pressure, which is very good if you have a stiff neck like some of us get from sitting at computers for long hours every day. And of course, it is luxury without the markup. They use premium materials, and yet their prices are up to 50% less than leading brands. GhostBed provides high quality and super comfortable award-winning mattresses crafted in the United States and Canada. So I haven't tried the mattresses, but if they're made with this same cooling technology, then I'm sure they keep you cool all night too. And considering that 60% of U.S. adults report being too hot when they're trying to sleep, that can be really important. The Ghostbed people design all of their products with these cooling features so you can stay comfortable and asleep, which is great, all night. You can pair any of their mattresses with Ghostbed's award-winning adjustable base and get the ultimate sleep experience. They are family-owned. They have had 60,000 five-star reviews, and they are handcrafted and made in the USA and Canada. Even better, you get a 101-night at-home sleep trial on all mattresses and pillows, a 20-plus year warranty, and what more could you need? Oh, well, free shipping and returns on mattresses, and most products ship within 24 hours. Right now, during Ghostbed's Black Friday sale, you get 25% off already reduced prices for a limited time. Just go to ghostbed.com/Mona and use promo code Mona at checkout. That's Ghostbed, G-H-O-S-T, bed.com/Mona, promo code Mona. Upgrade your sleep with Ghostbed, the makers of the coolest beds in the world. Some exclusions apply. See site for details. I want to talk for a minute, if we can, because one of the things that the administration's defenders will say is, first of all, everybody does it. Don't be naive. The previous administrations have used their power in exactly the same way to get their preferred policies implemented. And they say, in particular about Biden, that regarding COVID and regarding certain things that they pressured private companies to remove speech that they didn't like. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. Did you follow the Biden administration's actions there? And what do you make of that comparison?
Absolutely. We followed it at FIRE, yeah. And we criticized it at mm-hmm. FIRE, and we have been pushing forward model legislation that, in addition to the First Amendment, would help prevent it from happening again. Mm-hmm. We were in court in Murphy v. Missouri, that big seminal case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court to challenge the Biden administration and the Trump administration before them, frankly, some of the departments and agencies within the Trump administration from jawboning these social media companies over the content that they had on their platform related to COVID and to later the 2020 election. All of that is wrong. The government can't say, if you don't do this, something else bad is going to happen to you, whether it's losing your Section 230 protections or some other threat. So we opposed it then. And we cheered the Trump administration when, on the first day he comes into office, he issues an executive order prohibiting his government from pressuring private companies to censor their users if they're a social media platform or mm-hmm. otherwise engage in a form of censorship. How did that turn out, right? It hasn't turned out very well. This administration is doing more jawboning than the Biden administration in many different ways. Trump, it feels like every other week, is on True Social, jawboning a private company into censoring. He was just the other day talking about how Seth Meyers, a late night comedian, is probably engaged in illegal conduct for being too anti-Trump. He, when asked about Attorney General Pam Bondi's suggestion that they would prosecute hate speech, mm-hmm. which isn't a category of speech exempted from First Amendment protection.
Right.
He was asked by an ABC reporter about that. He said, you're probably engaged in hate speech.
Yep.
You work for ABC, and ABC has had so much hate speech against me.
Me.
Against me. Maybe Pam Bondi should look into that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All of this is sort of blatant jawboning where what used to be the quiet part is now said out loud. Like, the Biden administration wasn't broadcasting that they were pressuring these social media companies into censorship. That was later revealed through the Twitter files and other reporting. Now it's just being broadcast And I think, unfortunately, has the effect of desensitizing us in some ways to the censorship. The more routine it becomes.
Can I interrupt just briefly, though, to say this? Look, I think that the Biden people probably skated up to the pretty close to the edge there with what they were saying to the social media companies about taking things down. That was maybe a little bit heavy-handed from a government point of view, and I would be against it, kind of. But I also feel that at least in their case, they were attempting, as they saw it, to save lives. They did not want false information like take hydroxychloroquine, you know, for your COVID symptoms. They didn't want people to be seeing that sort of thing. And so they were trying to lean on the social media companies to take down misinformation about COVID. It is such a different universe, the kinds of things that the Trump administration is trying to get people punished for or be, you know, or fired for. You know, the aftermath, well, respond to that. Do you agree or disagree?
I am weary anytime we start talking about an administration's good motives. They're trying to save lives. They're trying to prevent false information because you have claims of saving lives and preventing false information on both sides. I mean,
fair Trump's enough. First term, that's true.
Trump's first term, he spent that entire term talking about fake news and how we need to go after the scourge of fake news. Right now, they're talking about, and Attorney General Pam Bondi is pressuring Apple and other social media platforms to take down these sort of ICE reporting groups or ICE reporting apps with the justification that it will save lives.
Yeah.
That's the same sort of thing the Biden administration was doing.
Well, except one is in good faith and the other's in bad faith, but I take your
That's
point.
A judgment call, right?
Yeah,
that's
it is.
A judgment call.
Yeah.
And I can't peek into the mind of Pam Bondi when she's reaching out to Apple and asking them to take down an ICE reporting app and wondering whether she's doing it in good faith or not. I mean, I like to presume good motives. I don't like to, as Christopher Hitchens put it, assume that someone's worst possible motive is their only possible motive, even when it's very clear sometimes that there are bad motives involved. But here, you know, you can go to your Waze or your Google Maps app and see where the police officer has their speed gun up anytime you want. But another app can't identify where law enforcement is if they're ICE. That just doesn't make any sense.
Right, in my belief.
And I'd like to think the administration should know better, especially after it spent years condemning what the Biden administration was doing. But yeah, that's a long way of answering your question. There are claims on each side, and I don't like to get in the world of subjective judgment when we're talking about the First Amendment.
When something isn't resisted, it's encouraged. Or you said words to that effect.
Yeah, behavior that gets rewarded gets repeated.
Gets repeated. Thank you. Yes. Now, we have seen maybe the lowest moment, at least from my perspective, other than the Jimmy Kimmel thing, which was pretty blatant.
That was pretty bad.
Where you had Carr just outright threatening the network. You know, nice network you've got there, to be ashamed if something were to happen to it.
You know, that's the phrase that we used to use to kind of be emblematic or to characterize how these government officials were acting. They didn't actually use those words. That would be too absurd. But in this case, Brendan Carr literally said, we can do this the easy way or the hard way.
Yeah, there you go.
It was unbelievable. Talk about saying the quiet part out loud.
It's mob boss talk. It's just amazing. But even lower than that moment was what happened after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, in my opinion, where you had the vice president and other high-ranking officials saying, we are going to go after anyone who didn't express what we think is the proper amount of sadness, reverence for this person. And further, they claimed that it was a conspiracy, that he had not been murdered by a random person, but that it was anybody who had views with which they disagreed was responsible for this murder, and therefore they were going to come after them and shut them down.
Yeah. I mean, I just say, at you know, as a first base here, that what happened to Charlie Kirk was an attack on free expression as well.
Of course, yes.
This was a man who was on a college campus, who had a sign that said, debate me, or prove me wrong behind him, and who was assassinated for engaging in a back and forth with someone who he disagrees with.
That's true.
I mean, that was one of the biggest attacks on free expression that I've seen in my long career here at FIRE. And we had, the day before, just released a survey that found that something like a third of college students believe that it is okay in some circumstances to use violence to shut down a speech on a college campus. And the next day, Charlie Kirk gets assassinated. And this is one of the downstream effects of left-wing censorship, where they started equating words with violence.
Yeah.
If words are violence, then you are justified in using violence against words.
Yeah.
Or at least reason or logic would suggest you are. Mm-hmm. And we have always said that words are the things we use instead of violence.
Absolutely.
Sigmund Freud said that civilization was started the day man first cast a word instead of a stone. And to erase that distinction is to erase, I think, one of the core components of any civilized society. Now, that said, what happened in the aftermath of the Charlie Kirk attack and what is still happening today is, as you said, an administration going after critics who do not speak reverent enough of his name. J.D. Vance went on a show, I believe it was the Charlie Kirk show even, to talk about how they were going to go after these folks. And Pam Bondi made her comments about hate speech in the context of critics of Charlie Kirk who had said distasteful, offensive things about him. Now, in some of these cases, it's not even folks who said they were happy that he were dead. In some cases, it's folks who lost their job because they said that his legacy was complicated or that he was racist or some other thing that they are entitled to say because it is an expression of an opinion. So it's deeply chilling what we saw in the wake of the Kirk assassination, just as the Kirk assassination itself was deeply chilling.
And once again, it's really important to make this distinction that having a right to freedom of expression is a right that the government is bound to respect. The government cannot deprive you of the right to speak. It's in the Constitution. And they can't punish you for words, unless in very rare circumstances, fighting words or when it's right, you know, when violence is imminent, and we don't have to go into all that.
Yeah.
There are some rare exceptions. But it is also true that when you speak, you know, there can be social sanctions, and that is not censorship. That is criticism or consequences for saying what you believe. But where it gets dicey, and I'd love for you to address this, is do you want to live in a society where the social sanctions have become so strict and so rigid that even though it's not the government acting, you still feel under a chill about expressing yourself?
It's a great question. So one of the seminal works on free expression is John Stuart Mill's 1859 treatise on liberty. He wrote that during what he saw as the stultifying conformity of Victorian England. It's a treatise not against government censorship, although that's, you know, implicated. It's a treatise against an orthodox conformist culture that doesn't allow for any dissent, disagreement, or marginal views to be expressed. My perspective on all of this, as you say, yes, in the absence of government censorship, what we have is social sanction. And social sanction is itself a form of expression. Private employers are free to fire people that don't meet their company's values or say something offensive. They're free to fire people in at-will employment for pretty much any reason, that so long as it's not an unlawful reason, like racial or sexual discrimination, for example. At the same time, I'd prefer to raise my three boys in a society where our first instinct in response to hearing something we disagree with isn't to figure out how to punish that person or get them fired from their job, but rather to figure out how to change their mind, to meet bad speech with more speech. I think that's a healthy free speech culture. We at FIRE talk about free speech law all the time, but we also talk about free speech culture, a culture in which we are accepting of disagreement, where we don't write someone off as soon as they say something that offends us, where we understand that in a democracy, the only way this sort of government can work is when we talk across lines of difference and attempt to change minds and find compromise. A culture that resorts to censorship, to mob censorship or government censorship first, is not a culture that's going to be too supportive of free expression. And it's not going to be a culture that understands and is willing to engage in the necessary work of democracy. I think people should be free to engage in devil's advocacy. I think people should be free to put forward an idea, play with it a little bit, and then reject it without, for example, being cast with that idea for the rest of their lives. You're having 14-year-olds who tweeted something stupid who are then having that dredged up when they are appointed to become the editor of Teen Vogue. It's ridiculous. It's not a culture I want to live with, and I want to get back to those old idioms that you were talking about. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. To each his own. It's a free country. These are things we used to tell ourselves. They're indicative of a free speech culture, and to the extent we lose those idioms, as my colleague Greg Lukianoff's like to say, we lose that culture that built America.
So you mentioned the mob, and I think it's widely agreed these days that social media sort of empowered mob behavior to a really remarkable degree in the last decade or decade and a half. Do you think that has crested and is now in in remission a little bit, or do you think that is still something that is defining the way we interact?
I think it'll define the way we interact for the rest of our lifetimes until the only people who are writing are the artificial intelligences. But I do think the cancel culture that came to be embodied over the last, decade or so, that came to define that mob censorship, has crested. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said famously that America is a pendulum. When it swings too far in one direction, it swings back often too far in the other direction. Some folks have talked about the left-wing cancellation culture being one of virtue signaling. And now, as the pendulum swings far in the other direction, you have a right-wing cancel culture that is vice signaling, more or less, and that is canceling people in the other direction. I want to figure out some way to stop this pendulum, right? Like right in the middle, like maybe let's not censor at all. Maybe let's be able to have debate and disagreement across lines of difference. Like it feels like we once did. I don't know. I'm 35 years old. I don't know if I lived during the golden age of debate and disagreement, but I remember the days when one of my mentors, Ira Glasser, the former executive director of the ACLU, could be friends with William F. Buckley and go on the train to a Mets baseball game together. Or when Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to bring her up again, could be friends with Justice Antonin Scalia. Where, as I mentioned earlier, Christopher Hitchens said, our worst possible motive wasn't our only possible motive or seen to be our only possible motive. So I don't know. It's every technological development or revolution brings with it a period that is anarchic. The printing press led to centuries of war in Europe. The 30 Years' War, 8 million dead or 6 million dead, I believe, in Germany alone. Is it worth it for having the printing press? I mean, it's easy for us to say half a millennium down the road. I think we will look back at social media and soon-to-be artificial intelligence and these anarchic periods and say, boy, that was tough. But humans are adaptable. We learn civic literacy. And at some point, I would hope that we would try and create a culture that values something that's not just dunking on our ideological opponents. And that would hopefully lead to a political culture as well, where we don't just target and persecute our political opponents. But that might be the triumph of hope over experience. We'll see.
An organization that I'm associated with called More in Common does polling and kind of in-depth surveys about people's views. And they've identified what they call the exhausted majority, where, people they're not hard right or hard left, and they reject and find all of the vitriol on both sides really exhausting. I think a key to climbing out of this hole we're in will be finding a way to reach that exhausted majority and try to convince them that there is a better alternative. I'm going to leave you with a slightly more with a slightly amusing story, if you will, because it involves platforming, which is where we began. So this is many years ago. So I used to be on CNN's show Crossfire. I was occasional host, and then I did a different CNN show called Capital Gang. But Crossfire was famous at the time for being a debate program where they would have one person on the right, one person on the left, and then two guests, and they or one or two guests, and they would debate it out. One time early in the show's life, they decided to invite on a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. So this guy comes on and he's wearing the white robe and the whole thing. And Tom Braden, who was the man on the debater on the left, you know, launches into his first question for the guest. And he says, "You are reprehensible. How could you come before the American people wearing that uniform, which represents so much hatred, so much violence, everything that's terrible about American history? How dare you come here? What made you think you should wear that thing tonight?" And the guest said, "Your producer told me to."
Oh, that's a producer who knows how to get an audience.
Exactly. So there in a nutshell is the source of a lot of our woes.
But let me put it this way as well. Even members of the Ku Klux Klan aren't beyond redemption. So I've had the privilege of getting to know this man named Daryl Davis. He's a black man who actually lives down the street in Maryland from Fire's offices. And over the past couple of decades, he has engaged in this practice of befriending members of the Ku Klux Klan, getting to know them, and through force of personality and friendship, not badgering, not moralizing, getting them to give up their Klan robes. I visited his house. He brought out dozens and dozens and dozens of Klan robes from former Klans men who, after meeting him, decided that their prejudices and bigotry against black men and women were wrong. And now it might be an old school kind of Christian value that nobody's beyond redemption, nobody's beyond forgiveness. I'm not even a Christian myself. But I happen to think that those sorts of values are the values that are necessary in democracy and that undergird a strong free speech culture. Abraham Lincoln famously said, "Do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friend?" I would also add to that, "Do I not change my enemy's mind when I make them my friend?" I think any time that you can befriend your ideological opponents, you have a way of dulling their sharpest edges. And so I'd urge your listeners to consider that the next time they hear someone who they vehemently disagree with. Ask yourselves, are they beyond redemption? Is there not a conversation that can be had here?
Well, that is a beautiful place on which to end this conversation. I would also just urge everyone who is interested in matters of free speech to look up the work of FIRE. It's FIRE.org, where you can find everything you need to know about assaults on free expression and the efforts that FIRE is making to preserve those critical liberties. So, Nico, thank you so much for joining me today. Good luck on the book. When do you think we can see the book?
Well, the book is almost done.
Excellent.
I've got a little less than two chapters to go through, but then I've got to edit it. Then it's got to go to the publisher. My deadline's March 2nd. I've got to also endnote it, which I'm dreading.
Oh, you're so ahead of the game. You're one of those good students. Gosh, that's excellent.
I will say that, yes, when I was in college, I was the sort of student that would look at the syllabus on the first day of class and ask myself, what can I get done now so that I'm not crashing at the finish line there. But the book will probably be out early 2027. You've written books. You know how it goes. There's usually a long timeline, unless you're a best-selling author like you are, in which case you can sometimes convince the publisher.
Nah, I wasn't able to convince them. I tried very hard to get them to move it faster, and they are just publishers are still on a 19th century schedule for reasons that I don't understand, unless you're, you know, a celebrity, in which case they managed to turn it over overnight.
Well, it's hard, Mona, because we had just had a conversation about how quickly things are moving in the world of free speech. Before I got on this call with you, I looked at my spreadsheet of all the things that Trump administration has done on free speech just in the past, 10 months? You know, it's 70 lines.
Yeah.
So I got to write this book with that in mind.
And it's going
to
be,
by the time I submit it to the publisher on March 2nd and it comes out on March 2nd, 2027, the dynamics are going to shift.
It's so frustrating. I agree. They should really, somebody needs to reform the publishing industry, but I bet that'll happen. Our robot masters, the AI robot masters, will solve all this.
Well, the Bulwark is building a robust multimedia company. Maybe you get a publishing arm as well.
Yeah, well, we'll have to look into that. Thanks so much for joining me.
All right. Thanks, Mona. It's been a pleasure.